And that's when he saw him, Periwinkle, on TV, sitting in the studio, talking to the anchors. Under his name it said, Packer Campaign Consultant. They were asking him what drew him to the job. Sometimes the country thinks it deserves a spanking, sometimes it wants a hug, Periwinkle said. When it wants a hug, it votes Democrat. I'm hedging on it's a spanking moment right now.
It's time to go now, sir, the man with the clipboard said.
One second.
Conservatives tend to believe more than the rest of us that we need a spanking. Read into that whatever you want.
Periwinkle laughed.
The anchors laughed. He was a natural on television. Right now, the country sees itself as a poorly behaved child, he continued. When people vote, what they're really doing way deep down is externalizing some childhood trauma. We have reams of paper showing this.
It's really time to go now, sir. The man with the clipboard was getting impatient.
Okay, fine, Samuel said. And he let himself be escorted away from the television toward the exterior doors. But just before leaving, he turned around. He turned in time to see his mother collect her belongings on the other side of security. And she didn't look for him. She didn't wave at him. She simply gathered her things and left. And thus, Samuel endured, for the second time in his life, the sight of his mother walking away, disappearing, and not coming back.
Part 9. Revolution. Late Summer, 1968. 1. The Conrad Hilton ground floor bar is separated from the street by panes of thick, leaded plate glass windows that muffle all but the closest sirens or screams. The Hilton's front entrance is guarded by a phalanx of police officers, who themselves are being watched over by a great many Secret Service agents, all of whom are making sure anyone coming into the Hilton is registered and unthreatening. Delegates, their wives, candidates' support staff, the candidates themselves, Eugene McCarthy and the vice president, they're here, as are some minor artist-type celebrities, Arthur Miller and Norman Mailer being the two that at least a couple of the cops recognize. The bar itself is full of delegates today, and the lights are appropriately low to accommodate the privacy needed to lubricate the political process. Small packs of intense-looking men in booths talk quietly, make promises, trade favors. Everyone has a cigarette and most have martinis, and the music is jazz and big band stuff. Think Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Tommy Dorsey, at a volume great enough to obscure nearby conversations, but not so loud that anyone needs to shout. Television over the bar tuned to CBS News. Delegates walking around the bar and seeing friends and slapping hands and backs because roughly the same people come to these things every time. Ceiling fans twirl just fast enough to draw the cigarette mist up and scatter it. Outsiders to the political process sometimes complain that real decisions happen in dark, smoky rooms. And this is one of those rooms. Two guys at the bar that absolutely no one approaches or fucks with. Mirrored sunglasses, black suits, obviously Secret Service, off-duty, watching the news and sipping glasses of something clear. The buzz in the room dies down momentarily when a hippie breaks through the police line and sprints down Michigan Avenue and gets himself tackled right outside the plate glass windows of the bar, and all the patrons inside, everyone but the two Secret Service guys, stop and watch the scene made wavy by the leaded glass as the police officers in their baby blue uniforms descend on the poor guy and club him on his back and legs, while inside the bar nobody can hear a thing, except maybe sometimes old Cronkite talking on CBS and Glenn Miller playing Rhapsody in Blue. 2. Way up above them on the top floor suite of the Conrad Hilton Hotel, Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey wants another shower. This will be his third shower of the day, and his second since returning from the amphitheater. He tells the maid to run the water, and his staff looks at him queerly. They were at the amphitheater this morning, so Triple H could practice his speech. His staff likes to call him Triple H, but the Secret Service agents refuse, usually calling him Mr. Vice President Sir, which he prefers. They were at the amphitheater so he could stand at that podium and imagine the crowd and visualize his speech and think positive thoughts, like the management consultants told him to do. To imagine the crowd in that vast space, that huge space big enough to hold every resident of his hometown plus many thousands more. And he was up there mentally going through his speech and savoring the applause lines and thinking positive thoughts and repeating, "They want me to win. They want me to win." But all he could really think about was that smell. That unmistakable smell of animal feces with an undersweetness of blood and cleaning agents. That cloud hanging over the stockyards. What a place to have your convention. The smell still lingers on his clothes, even though he's changed clothes. He can still smell it in his hair and under his fingernails. If he can't get rid of this smell, he thinks he's going to go crazy. He needs another shower. To hell with what the staff thinks. 3. Meanwhile, one story underground, Faye Anderson stares at shadows on the wall. This jail, it turns out, is not the official or permanent city jail, but rather a makeshift holding pen that looks like it was quickly erected in a storage room of the Conrad Hilton Hotel. The cells are made not from iron bars, but from chain-link fencing. She's been sitting on the floor ever since the last of her panic attacks, which had consumed her for most of the night. She had been photographed and fingerprinted and dragged to this cell, and the door was locked, and she pleaded into the darkness that there had been some terrible mistake, and wept at the thought of her family discovering she was arrested for, oh my God, prostitution. And the terror quaked through her body, and all she could do was curl up in a ball in the corner and feel her own rigid heartbeat and persuade herself she was not dying, even though she was convinced that this is what it felt like, to die. And after the third or maybe fourth attack, a strange calm came over her, a strange acceptance, maybe exhaustion. She was so tired. Her body rang from a night of spasms and tight dread. She lay on her back thinking maybe she'd sleep now, but she just stared into the darkness until the first dull glow of dawn slunk into the room through the basement's lone egress window. It is a gray-blue light, sickly-looking, like the light of deep winter, dispersed and faded and occluded by several panes of frosted glass. She can't see the window itself, but she can see its light cast on the far wall, and the shadows of things that pass by. First a few people, then many people. Then many people marching. Then the door opens, and that cop who'd arrested her last night, big, crew-cutted guy who still is not wearing a badge or name tag or anything identifiable, walks in. Faye stands up. The cop says,
"Basically, you have two choices."
"This is a mistake," Faye says. "A big misunderstanding."
"Choice number one, you leave Chicago immediately," the cop says. "Or choice two, stay in Chicago and go on trial for prostitution."
"But I didn't do anything."
"Also, you're high. Right now, you are abusing illegal narcotics. Those red pills you took. How do you think your daddy's gonna feel when he finds out you're a hooker and a doper?"
"Who are you? What did I do to you?"
"If you leave Chicago, this whole thing will go away. I'm trying to put this as plainly as I can. You leave, no harm done. But if I ever catch you in Chicago again, I promise you'll regret it for the rest of your life." He gives the cage a shake to test its sturdiness. "I'll give you the weekend to think about it," he said. "See you when the protest is over."
He leaves and locks the door behind him, and Faye sits down and stares again at the shadows. Above her, the big parade is fully underway, is what she thinks, seeing the forms cast on the opposite wall. Thin shadows that look like snapping scissors held upside down are almost certainly legs, she thinks. People marching. The city must have backed down, issued a permit. Then a rumbling and associated large window-blocking shadows she assumes are pickup trucks. Their beds filled with student protesters, she imagines, waving their homemade peace flags. She's glad for them, that Sebastian and the others got their way, that the biggest demonstration of the year, of the decade, is happening after all. 4. But the shadows are in fact not those of parading students. They are those of National Guard troop carriers filled with soldiers holding rifles tipped with bayonets. There is no parade. The city has not backed down. The shadows that Faye sees are cast by cops moving this way and that to contain the surge of screaming demonstrators massing across the street. In case any of them have designs on parading, the troop carriers have cages of razor wire attached to their front grills to show them just how unwelcome they are in the street. They all gather in Grant Park, the many thousands of them, where Allen Ginsberg now sits in the grass, cross-legged, palms raised to the universe, listening. Around him, young people scream and revolutionize. They place their spit curses on Police State USA, the FBI, the president, petty materialist, sexless, soulless bourgeoisie killers, their bombs death-dropping on farmers and children a billion tons. "It's time to bring the war to the streets," says one nearby bullhorned youth. "We're gonna shut down Chicago, fuck the police, and anybody who's not with us is a bourgeois white honky pig!" Ginsberg trembles at this. He does not want to take these children to war, misery, despair, bloody police nightsticks, and death. The thought barbed wires his guts. One cannot react to violence with violence. Only a machine thinks like this, or a president, or a vengeful monotheism. Imagine instead 10,000 naked youths carrying signs that say, "Police don't hurt us, we love you too." Or crowned with flowers, sitting cross-legged, waving pure white flags, chanting glory, Nirvana poems to their holy maker. This is the other way to react to violence with beauty, and Ginsberg wants to say this. He wants to say to the bullhorn man, "You are the poem you are asking for." He wants to soothe them. The way forward is like water. But he knows it isn't good enough, isn't radical enough to calm the wild appetite of the young. And so Ginsberg strokes his beard, closes his eyes, settles into his body, and answers in the only way he can, with a deep bellow from the bottom of his belly, the great syllable, the sacred sound of the universe, the perfection of wisdom, the only noise worth making at a time like this. Om. He feels the hot, holy breath in his mouth, the lifted-up music breath released from his lungs and his gullet, from his guts and heart, his stomach, his red blood cells and kidneys, from his gallbladder and glands and the long, spindly legs he sits on. The syllable issues from all these things. If you listen quietly and carefully, if you are calm and you slow down your heart, you can hear the syllable in everything. The walls, the street, the cars, the soul, the sun. And soon you are no longer chanting. Soon the sound settles into your skin and you are simply hearing the body make the sound it has always made. Om. Children with too much education have problems with the syllable because they do their thinking with their minds and not their bodies. They think with their heads and not their souls. The syllable is what remains when you get out of your mind after you minus the great you. Ginsberg sometimes likes to pair them up and touch his hands to the tops of their heads and say, "You're married," to make them think about what happens next, on the honeymoon. For all their talk of free love, they need desperately the debauch of other bodies. They need desperately out of their own brains. He wants to scream at them, "You are carrying lead souls!" He wants them to lob their haunted heads into bliss devotion. Here they are trying to murmur the syllable and getting it all wrong. Because they treat it like a lab rat or a poem. Break it apart, dissect it, explain and expose the viscera. They think the syllable is a ritual, figurative, a symbol for God, but they are wrong. When you're bobbing in the ocean, the water does not symbolize wetness. The water is simply there, lifting you up. That is the syllable, the universe's deep bellow, like water. Omnipresent, endless, perfect. It's the touch of God in the loftiest place. The most exalted place, the eminent, the pinnacle, the highest, the eighth. Om, he says. 5. And above them all, a helicopter screams north now at the news of some impromptu illegal cavalcade on Lakeshore Drive. A company of girls marching and shouting and raising their fists in the air, and high-stepping it right down the middle of the road, slapping their palms on the windshields of cars, exhorting the drivers to join them on their procession south, which the drivers universally do not do. The chopper reaches them and points its camera at them, and people watching this on TV,
People like Faye's father and Faye's several burly uncles, who are all gathered right now in a living room in her little Iowa River town 200 miles distant from Chicago, but linked to it via television. They say, "They're all girls?" Well, yes, this particular cluster of protesting student radicals are, sure enough, all girls. Or presumably so. Several are wearing handkerchiefs over their faces, so it's hard to tell. Others have these haircuts that make the uncle say, "That one looks like a man." They are right now watching on the best TV owned among them, a 23-inch Zenith color console as large as a boulder that comes to life with an electric thwomp. And they want their friends and wives to see what they're seeing, to hear what they're hearing, because what these girls are yelling, they are yelling crazy shit. They are yelling, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh," and stabbing their fists in the air at each syllable, just completely ignoring all the cars honking at them, not even moving for oncoming traffic, just daring these cars to run them down like bowling pins, which the uncles wish they'd do, the cars. Run the girls down. Then they look at Frank sheepishly and say, "I'm sure Faye's not there." And Frank nods, and everything is real quiet and awkward until one of the uncles breaks the tension, saying, "You see what that chick is wearing?" And they all nod and make various sounds of disgust, because it's not like the uncles think all women should dress like debutantes, but come on! These girls make those girls who protested outside Miss America look like Miss America. Because, okay, here's an example. This leader girl that the cameras keep showing because she's in front of the horde and seems responsible for the forward-moving progress of the horde, here is what she's wearing. First, army jacket, which the uncles agree is so low-down disrespectful patriotism-wise, which is point A. Point B is that army jackets are not form-fitting or flattering for girls because they are made for a man. And this girl knew she'd be on TV, and this is how she wishes to present herself, in a jacket inappropriate to her gender. Which leads them to point C, which is that she probably wants to be a man secretly on the inside. Which they think, okay, fine, draft the bitch like a man and send her to Vietnam like a man and let her hump it through the jungle on point duty, watching for tripwires and unexploded ordnance and snipers. And then we'll see how much she's loving on Ho Chi Minh. "But she hasn't showered in days," one of the uncles says. "How many days?" 6 days is where they put the over-under. The news identifies this leader girl as someone named Alice, who, the news says, is a well-known campus feminist. And the uncles huff and snort, and one of them says, "That figures." And they all nod because they understand exactly what he means by that. 6. The Conrad Hilton's first floor bar is called the Haymarket, and this seems historically significant to at least one of the two Secret Service agents sitting at the bar right now nursing his non-alcoholic drink. "Like, as in the Haymarket riot," says Agent A. "The Haymarket massacre? Anything?" To which Agent B, whose chin hangs over the glass of club soda he really wishes had bourbon in it, shakes his head. "Nope," he says. "I got nothing." "It was in Chicago? 1880-something? Workers striking at Haymarket Square? It's pretty historic." "I thought Haymarket Square was in Boston." "There's one here, too. It's northeast of us, about 2 clicks. "What were they striking for?" asks B. "An 8-hour workday." "God, I'd love one of those right about now." A shakes his glass, and the bartender fills it. His preferred off-duty drink is this thing involving simple syrup, lemon juice, and rosewater. You can't always find rosewater in most places, but the Haymarket Bar, it turns out, is well-stocked. "What happened," A says, "is that they were demonstrating, the workers were, marching and picketing, and then the police showed up and attacked them, and then a bomb went off."
"Casualties?"
"Several. Perp?"
"Unknown."
"And you're bringing this up now because..."
"Because don't you think it's a coincidence that we're in the Haymarket Bar right now?"
"Riot Central," says B, pointing with his thumb behind them toward the thousands of protesters currently gathered beyond the plate glass windows.
"That's what I'm saying."
"A real headly medley out there." Agent A looks sidelong at his partner.
"A real hugger-mugger, you might say."
"Yep, gone all topsy-turvy."
"A sincere higgledy-piggledy."
"Yes, sir, 100% hurly-burly."
"A pell-mell."
"A ribble-rabble."
"A skimble-scamble."
They smile at each other and suppress a laugh. They clink their drinks. They could do this all day.
Outside, the crowd churns and boils.
7. And where there looks to be an oval-shaped cavity in the crowd is actually the spot where dozens are sitting. They're watching Allen Ginsberg or joining him in his oming, his head bopping, clapping, his face uplifted like he's receiving messages from the gods. To the anxious and terrified crowd, his chanting is barbiturative. In its monotony and resolve and purpose, it is the verbal equivalent of being held tenderly by a nurse who really cares. Those who join him singing om feel better about the world. This is their armor, the spoken sacred syllable. Nobody would strike someone sitting on the ground singing om. Nobody would gas them. Around Grant Park, this calm, this peace has rippled out to the far borders. Protesters standing there lost in the crowd, screaming at the cops and maybe digging up chunks of sidewalk to throw at the Conrad Hilton Hotel, in a spasm of loose rage and wildness because they're just so angry at all of it, when someone touches their shoulder from behind and they turn to find these gentle, soothing eyes made tranquil and serene because they themselves were touched by the person behind them, and they in turn by the person behind them, one long chain leading all the way back to Ginsberg, who's powering this whole thing with his chanting's great voltage. He has enough peace for all of them. They feel part of his song pour into them, and they feel its beauty, and then they are its beauty. They and the song are the same. They and Ginsberg are the same. They and the cops and the politicians are the same, and the snipers on the roofs, and the Secret Service agents, and the mayor, and the newsmen, and the happy people inside the Haymarket Bar bopping their heads to music they cannot hear. All of them are one. The same light threads through them all. And thus a calm comes over the crowd, in a slow circle around the poet, moving outward from him like ripples on water, like in that Basho poem he loves so much, the ancient pond, the still night. A frog jumps in. Kerplunk. 8. Girls still marching south, white girls, black girls, brown girls, close-ups on their faces now, chanting, yelling. There are, in the uncle's opinion, three kinds of girls, long horse-faced girls and wide muffin-faced girls and bulging bird-faced girls. This girl at the front of this march, this Alice person, has a lot of horse in her, they think. Ha ha, a horse in her, ha ha. Mostly horse, but a bit of the bird, too. What they can see of her face, anyway, that part of her not covered by sunglasses or ratty hair. Two parts horse face, one part bird face is where they'd plot her on the 3D map of girl faces. Except she is carrying a weapon, which puts her in a whole other category. Girl faces just look different when they're all violent like that. Actually, almost all the girls in the crowd are carrying weapons, 2x4s, some with these evil-looking rusty nails sticking out of the swinging end, and rocks and chunks of pavement. And iron bars and bricks and bags with unknown contents, but their guess? Shit and piss, plus menstrual blood. Gross. The TV says there's rumors of radicals buying huge amounts of oven cleaner and ammonia, which sounds like bomb-making material, even if the uncles are not 100% sure of the chemistry of this. But if anyone would be carrying oven cleaner explosives, it would be one of these girls, because they figure girls have routine access to such things. CBS has cut away from old Cronkite for a moment and is just showing all this live and unedited. And most people tune into CBS to hear old Cronkite deliver his assessment about things. But the uncle's opinion about it, about not seeing Cronkite right now, they think, good. The guy's gotten a little soft lately, a little lefty too, and arrogant, all these puffed up pronouncements from the top of Mount Journalism or something. They prefer their news from the source, undiluted. Case in point. Girls walking south in the middle of the street. This is action. This is news untouched. Especially now as a cop car rolls up and instead of dispersing like they ought to, the girls actually attack the cop car, jabbing at the siren with baseball bats, breaking the windows with rocks. And the poor cop leaps out of the other side of the car and holy cow is that boy running. And even though it's only girls, he's running from there's like 100 of them and they mean business. Then the girls all gather on the car, and it looks like a bunch of ants surrounding a beetle ready to devour it. And the leader horse-faced girl yells, heave-ho! And they actually tip over the police car. It's the most amazing thing the uncles have ever seen. And the girls all cheer at their job well done, and then continue marching and chanting, and the cop car's siren is still blowing.
But instead of at full volume, it's like a demoralized and sad siren sound. It moans and whines in this low, pitiful way. It sounds like an electronic toy whose batteries are just about dead. And now girls are yelling after the cop, yelling, "Here, piggy, piggy, oink, oink, swee!" And this is about the best thing the uncles have seen on television in a month.
9.
The Conrad Hilton Hotel is nowhere near the convention. The Democratic National Convention will happen at the International Amphitheater down on the grounds of the Union Stockyards, about 5 miles south of here. But the amphitheater is completely inaccessible. A barbed wire fence surrounds it, National Guard troops patrol the grounds, every manhole cover has been tarred shut, roadblocks at every intersection, even airplanes are banned from flying over it. Once the delegates are inside the amphitheater, there would be no reaching them. Hence the protest at the Hilton, where all the delegates are staying. Plus, there's the matter of the smell. It's all Hubert Humphrey can think about. His staff is right now trying to tell him how the peace plank debate will go, but it's like every time he turns his head, he can smell it again. Whose idea was it anyway to hold a convention next to a slaughterhouse? He could sense them, smell them, hear them, the poor animals huddled and dying hundreds per hour to feed a prosperous nation. Trucked in as infants, trucked out as parts. He could smell the hogs insane with fear, the hogs hanging from hooks, their stomachs opened in cascades of blood and pig barf. The smell of bright raw ammonia used to clean the addled floors, creatures in their death fear releasing cries and stink glands, a terror both audible and olfactible. The chemical breath of a million aborted animal screams, aromatized and blooming into the atmosphere, a sour, meaty vapor. The perfume of slaughter is at once nauseating and fascinating, the way the body is tuned to another body's loss. A pile of manure that rose even above the barbed wire fences, 15 feet tall, dropped, TP-shaped in a fit of copromania, sitting raw in the sun and cooking, like some kind of ancient evil bubbling up out of the Pleistocene. An organic mud that tanged the air and locked itself in fabric and hair.
"What kind of abomination is that?"
Triple H asked, pointing at the shit cone. His security men laughed. They were the sons of farmers. He was the son of a pharmacist. His only encounter with this kind of biology came after it was processed and pulverized. He wanted to stuff his nose in his own armpit. The smell was more like a weight than a gas. It felt like the whole moral rot of the world taking shape and form right here in Chicago.
"Somebody light a match," said one of the agents.
The smell is on him still. The maid says the washroom is ready. Thank God. At this point, a shower is more analgesic than anything else.
10. Faye is in jail roughly 9 hours before the ghost appears. She is kneeling, hands clasped, facing the far wall where shadows flicker by. And she asks God for help, says she'll do anything, anything at all. "Please," she says, rocking, "whatever you want." And she does this until she feels dizzy, and she begs her body to let her sleep. But when she closes her eyes, she feels like one big, long, plucked guitar string, all shaky and furious. And so it's during this in-between state of being too exhausted to stay awake, but too agitated to fall asleep, that the ghost appears to her. She opens her eyes and senses a presence nearby, and looks around and sees, on the far wall, illuminated by the window's dull blue light, this creature. He looks like, maybe, a gnome or a small troll. Actually, he looks exactly like the figurine of a house spirit her father gave her so many years ago, the Nisa. He is small and round, maybe 3 feet tall, hairy, white-bearded, fat, caveman-faced. He leans against the wall with his arms crossed and his legs crossed and his eyebrows raised, looking at Faye skeptically, as if he doesn't believe in her existence rather than the other way around. She might have otherwise panicked at this sight, but her body is so tired. "I'm dreaming," she says.
"So wake up,"
the house spirit says. She tries to wake up. She knows the thing that usually pulls her out of dreaming is the realization that she's dreaming, which has always frustrated her.
Dreams, she thinks, are best when you know they're dreams. Then you can act without consequence. It's the only time in her life that is worry-free.
Well,
the ghost says. You're not real, she says, even though she has to admit this does not feel like a dream. The house spirit shrugs.
You spend all night praying for help, and when help finally arrives, you insult it. That is so typical of you, Faye.
I'm hallucinating, she says, because of those pills.
Look, if I'm not wanted here, if you've got this situation under control, then best of luck to you. There are plenty of people out there who would appreciate my help.
He points a stubby finger toward the window, the outside world.
Listen to them, he says.
And just then the big basement room is crashing with sound. The discordant and overlapping voices of people pleading for help, asking for protection, voices young and old, male and female, as if the room were suddenly a radio tower picking up every frequency on the dial all at once, and Faye can hear students asking for protection from the cops, and cops asking for protection from the students, and priests asking for peace, and presidential candidates asking for strength, and snipers hoping they won't have to pull the trigger, and National Guardsmen staring obliquely at their bayonets asking for courage, and people everywhere offering whatever they can in return for safety. Promises that they'll start going to church more, that they'll be better people, that they'll call their parents or children soon, they'll write more letters, give to charity, be kind to strangers, stop doing whatever bad things they are currently doing, quit smoking, quit drinking, be a better husband or wife, a whole symphony of kindnesses that might result if they are simply spared on this one ugly day. Then, just as quickly, the voices turn off, and the basement is silent again, the last noise to fade being the low, deep thrum of someone chanting,
Om.
Faye stands and looks at the house spirit, who is himself looking innocently at his own fingernails.
Do you know who I am?
He says. You're my family's house spirit. Our Nisa.
That's one word for it.
What's another word? He looks at her, his eyes black and sinister.
All those stories your father told you about ghosts that look like rocks or horses or leaves? Yeah, that's me. I am the Nisa. I am the Nyx, not to mention various other spirits, creatures, demons, angels, trolls, etc.
I don't understand.
No, you wouldn't, he says, and he yawns. You guys haven't figured it out yet. Your map is just way off.
11. Now the girls have switched from Ho 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 Chi Minh to Kill the Pigs, Kill the Pigs. And the uncles are glued to the television because the girls are full of confidence after their cop car tipping success and obviously feel indestructible right now because they taunt the various cops they see along their slow march south yelling, Hey Piggy and Suey and stuff like that. And the reason this is unswitch-offable television and why the uncles keep yelling, Honey, come here, you've got to see this, and why they are considering calling all their buddies to make sure they're watching too is because the police and the National Guard, they're waiting for the bitches a couple blocks away. It's like a trap. They're to the west of the girls' route, waiting to flank them and drive into them and split open their wedge. Ha ha. And the girls have no idea this is about to happen. The uncles know this because of Chopper Cam. And right now, they are just about as grateful to Chopper Cam as they are to their mother on their birthdays. And they wish there was some way they could record for all time what is about to happen, and watch the Chopper Cam footage over and over and maybe put it in a scrapbook or time capsule or shoot it into space on the back of a satellite to show the Martians or whoever the hell else is out there some pretty goddamn entertaining TV. And the Martians, the first thing they'll say when they land their flying saucers on the White House lawn, they'll say, those girls had it coming. About 100 cops in riot gear wait for the girls, and behind them a platoon of National Guardsmen in gas masks, holding rifles with fucking daggers attached to the barrels, and behind them this monstrous metal thing with nozzles on the front like some kind of terrible Zamboni from the future that the TV folks tell them the purpose of, which is gas.
tear gas. 1,000 gallons. And they're waiting behind a building for the girls to come to them, and the uncles feel really present and edgy, and almost like they're with the cops or something, and they think that this moment, even though the uncles are hundreds of miles away from it, and all they're really doing is sitting on a couch watching an electronic box while their food goes cold, might be the best thing that has ever happened to them. Because this right here is the future of television. Pure combative sensation. Old Cronkite's problem is he's treating television like it's a newspaper, with all of Prince's worn-out obligations. Chopper Cam provides a new way forward. Faster, immediate, richly ambiguous. No gatekeepers between the event and the perception of the event. The news and the uncle's opinion about the news are flattened into a simultaneous happening. But the police are on the move now. Night sticks out, riot helmets down, and running, sprinting. And when the girls understand what is about to happen, their big march breaks apart like a rock exploded by gunshot. Pieces of it flying off in every direction. Some girls head back from the direction they came, only to be cut off by a paddy wagon and a squadron of cops who anticipated this very move. Others hop the barrier between northbound and southbound traffic and hightail it toward the lake. For most of the girls, the crowd is so thick there's nowhere to run, and so they trip over each other and fall and flail like a litter of blind puppies. And these are the ones the police reach first, bringing down their nightsticks on the girls' legs, the meat of their thighs, their backbones. The cops drop these bitches like they're mowing tall grass. A quick thrust and the girls bend and fall. From above, this looks like those slides from high school biology textbooks. Of the immune system wiping out a foreign agent, surrounding it and neutralizing it in blood. The cops pour into the crowd and everyone gets mixed up together. The uncles see the girls' mouths moving and they wish they could hear the screams above the rotary noise of the chopper. The cops drag the girls to a paddy wagon, mostly by their arms, some by their hair, some by their clothes, which gets the uncles momentarily jazzed up because maybe their hippie dresses will rip and they'll catch a little skin. Some of these girls are bleeding rivers from their heads, or dazed, sitting on the road, crying, or passed out on the curb. Chopper Cam looks around for that leader girl, Alice, but she took off south toward Grant Park to join with the rest of the hippies down by the Conrad Hilton, presumably. Which is too bad. That would have been fun to watch. The National Guard hasn't even gotten involved yet. They're watching and clutching their rifles and looking deadly as hell. The giant tear gas machine, incidentally, is rumbling slowly south toward the gathered masses at the park. The girls have, for the most part, dispersed entirely. A few run away on the lakefront beach, tearing ass across the sand in front of all these stunned families and lifeguards. Chopper Cam is now heading south to cover whatever's going on in the park, and that's when goddamn CBS cuts back to old Cronkite, who looks all shaken and pale, and has clearly been watching the same footage the uncles have been watching, but has come to a radically different conclusion. "The Chicago police," he says, "are a bunch of thugs." "Well, fiddle-dee-dee, how about that for bias?" One of the uncles leaps out of his chair and places a long-distance call to CBS headquarters, and he doesn't even mind how much this is costing him, because any amount would be worth it to give old Cronkite a piece of his mind. 12. Officer Charlie Brown, badgeless, anonymous, is sweeping the crowd for Alice, knowing Alice will be here in this particular all-girl march, and he's swinging his nightstick and feeling, right now as he connects with another hippie forehead, like Ernie Banks. Like Ernie Banks the instant after he hits another home run ball, and there's that tiny interval before the crowd cheers, and before he trots the bases, before he even leaves the batter's box, before anyone can locate the ball in the air and extrapolate its path and understand that it will clear Wrigley's Ivy. There must be this moment when the only person in the park who knows it's a home run is Ernie Banks himself. Even before he looks up to watch it fly away, there must be a moment when his head is still down, looking at the point in space where the baseball was a heartbeat ago. And the only information he has is the information that travels up the bat and into his hands, a percussion that feels just right. As if the ball has offered him no resistance whatsoever. So purely did he strike its exact middle with his bat's exact middle. And before anything else happens, there's this moment where it's like he has this secret he's dying to tell everyone else. He's just hit a home run.
but nobody else knows it yet. Brown is thinking about this as he clunks hippies on the head with his nightstick. He's pretending he's Ernie Banks. Because it's hard to get a square, solid hit every time. It's a real challenge of athleticism and coordination. Brown figures 3 out of every 4 swings ends up a glancing blow, his nightstick vibrating complainingly. The hippies squirm. They cannot be trusted to stay still for a beating. They are unpredictable. They try to protect themselves with their hands and arms. They twirl away at the last second. Roughly 3 out of 4 swings are these, he guesses. Misses. He's batting 250. Not as good as Ernie, but still respectable. But sometimes things line up. He anticipates the hippie's movements perfectly. The feel of the stick in his hand, the moist sound of the hippie's head, that hollow watermelon thumping sound, and that moment where the hippie suddenly doesn't know where she is or what's happening to her, when she literally does not know what just hit her, as her brain is up there sloshing around, and soon the hippie will tip over like a rootless tree, topple down and vomit and pass out. And Brown knows this will happen soon, but it has not happened yet, and he wishes he could live inside this moment forever. He wants this moment captured in a postcard or snow globe. The hippie about to fall, the triumphant cop above her, his nightstick having clunked the hippie and then kept going in its arc of perfect swinging technique, and the look on his face would be like Ernie Banks after crushing another one to dead center. That giddy and gratifying pleasure of a job well done.
13. Faye is exhausted. She hasn't slept in more than a day. She's leaning against the wall with her back to the room and trying to keep it all together, and she's just about crying from the effort. "Help me," she says. The house spirit sits on the floor outside her metal cage. He picks at his teeth with a fingernail.
"I could help you," he says. "I could make all this go away, if I felt like it."
"Please," Faye says.
"Okay. Make me a deal. Make it worth my time. Entertain me."
So Faye promises to be a better person, to help the needy and go to church, but the house spirit only smiles.
"What do I care about the needy?" he says. "What do I care about church?"
"I'll give money to charity," Faye says. "I'll volunteer and give money to the poor."
The house spirit says, spit flecking off his lips. "You're gonna have to do better than that. Gonna have to leave some skin on the table."
"I'll go back home," Faye says. "Go to junior college for a couple years and come back to Chicago after all this blows over."
"A couple years at JUCO, that's it? Seriously, Faye, that's not nearly enough penance for how badly you've acted."
"But what have I done?"
"Irrelevant. But if you'd like to know, disobeyed your parents, felt pride, coveted, thought impure thoughts. Plus, weren't you planning on having out-of-wedlock relations last evening?"
Faye hangs her head, says yes, because there is no use lying.
"Yes, the answer is yes. Plus, you're high. Right now, you are high. Plus, you shared a bed with another woman. Do I have to keep going? Do you want to hear more? Do I even need to mention what you did with Henry on the riverbank?"
"I give up," she says. The house spirit rubs his chin with a fat hand. "I should forget about this whole thing," she says. "Go home and marry Henry." The house spirit raises an eyebrow.
"Go on."
"I'll marry Henry and make him happy and forget about college, and we'll be normal, like everyone wants." The ghost smiles, his teeth ragged and broken, a mouthful of stones.
"Go on,"
he says. 14.
Now old Cronkite is interviewing the mayor, the fatly jowled and thuggish dictator of Chicago. Cronkite is asking him questions live on the air, but really the journalist's mind is elsewhere. He's barely paying attention. It doesn't matter. The mayor is as professional as they come. He doesn't need a journalist's questions to hold forth on whatever he wants to talk about, which is currently the extraordinary threats to the police and to ordinary Americans and to our democracy itself, posed by outside agitators, the out-of-town radicals causing trouble in his law-abiding town. He really seems to want to stress the out-of-town stuff, probably to emphasize to hometown voters that whatever problems his city is currently having are not his fault. And anyway, even if old Cronkite were concentrating real hard and asking penetrating, difficult questions, the mayor would just perform that politician's maneuver where he doesn't answer the question you asked, but instead the question he wished you had asked. And if you pursue this too much and insist that he did not answer the question, then you're the one who looks like a jerk. At least that's how it plays on TV. Badgering this very charismatic fellow who's been saying lots of words that at least seem related to the question. This is how it seems to the viewers, anyway, who are splitting their attention between Cronkite and children running around and cutting the Salisbury steak at the center of their TV dinners. If you keep pestering the politician, you look like a pest, and America does not tune in to watch pests. It's a chilling thought that politicians have learned to manipulate the television medium better than the television professionals themselves. When old Cronkite first realized this was happening, he imagined the kinds of people who would become politicians in the future. And he shuddered with fear. So he's ostensibly interviewing the mayor, but he knows that his only real job here is to stick a microphone under his mouth so CBS News can seem balanced by providing a counter-narrative to the images of police brutality they've been showing for hours. So old Cronkite isn't really listening. He's watching, maybe. The way the mayor seems to hold his head as far back on his neck as possible, in the manner of someone avoiding a bad smell, and how this makes the part of his chin that on a rooster would be called a wattle press out and jiggle while he speaks. It is impossible not to stare at this. So a bit of old Cronkite's mind is following this, watching the mayor's jello face wriggle, but mostly he's thinking about something else. He's thinking about, of all things, flying. He imagines he's a bird, flying over the city, at a height so great that everything is dark and quiet. This is occupying roughly three-quarters of Walter Cronkite's mind right now. He's a bird. He's a nimble, flying bird. 15. Faye is in her dark basement cell cringing in anticipation of another panic attack, because the house spirit's hot breath is right up next to her, and he's holding the chain-link fence and pressing his face against it, and his black eyeballs are bugging out, and he's telling her exactly what he's going to need from her, which is vengeance and retribution. But retribution for what? She wishes more than anything that her mother were here to stroke her forehead with a cold washcloth and tell her she's not dying, and hold her till she slept. And Faye would wake up in the morning, blanketed and warm, her mother beside her having fallen asleep sometime in the night while watching over her. Faye could use that tenderness right now.
"Yes, but where was your father when you needed him?" the ghost says. "Where is he now?"
Faye doesn't understand.
"Your father is a terrible, evil man. You must know this."
"Yes, I suppose. He kicked me out of the house."
"Oh, it's all about you, eh? Geez, Faye. Selfish."
"Okay, then he's evil. Why? Because he works at Chemstar?"
"Come on. You know what I'm talking about."
Faye's impression of her father is that of a mournful silence, sometimes staring off into the distance. A man who keeps everything locked up within. Always some slight melancholy, unless he was telling her stories of the old country. Stories about his family's farm, the only subject at which he seemed to brighten. Faye says, "He did something back home, didn't he? Before he came to the U.S.
Bingo, the ghost says. And now he's being punished for it, and you're being punished for it, and your family will continue to be punished for it to the third and fourth generation. Those are the rules.
That's not very fair.
Ha! Fair? What's fair? How the universe works and your sense of fairness are very different things.
He's an unhappy man, Faye says. Whatever he did, he's sorry for it.
Is it my fault that just about everyone on Earth by now is paying for some evil committed by a previous generation? No. The answer is no. It is not my fault.
They often wondered what passed before her father's eyes when he stared into the distance, when he stood in the backyard looking into the sky for an hour. He was always so maddeningly vague about his life before America. All he'd talk about was that house, that beautiful salmon-red house in Hammerfest. All other details were forbidden. Alice told me something, Faye says. She told me the way to get rid of a ghost is to take it home.
The house spirit crossed his arms.
That would be rich, he said. I would love to see that.
Maybe I should go to Norway, take you back where you came from.
Oh, I dare you. I double dare you. That would be seriously entertaining. Go on. Go to Hammerfest and ask about Frank Anderson. See how well that works for you.
Why? What would I find?
Probably better if you didn't know.
Tell me.
I'm just saying there are some mysteries of the universe that ought to remain mysteries.
Please.
Fine. Fair warning. You won't like it.
I'm listening.
You will find that you are as awful as your father is.
That's not true.
You will find that you two are exactly alike.
We are not.
Go ahead, try it. Go back to Norway. You've got yourself a deal. I'll let you out of jail right now, and in exchange, you go find out about your dad. Have fun with that.
And just then, the door to the room pops open, and light from buzzing overhead fluorescent lamps spills in, and there appears in the doorway, remarkably, Sebastian. With his bushy hair and baggy jacket, he sees her and comes to her. He has the keys to her cell. He opens the door and crouches down and takes her in his arms and whispers into her ear, I'm getting you out of here. Let's go. 16. By now, the mayor is practically lecturing at poor old Cronkite, who looks dispirited and withered and sad. There have been threats, is what the mayor's saying. Assassination attempts against all of the candidates. Bomb threats. Even threats against himself, the mayor. Old Cronkite doesn't seem to be looking at him, but at a spot just past him.
That true? Asks Agent B. About the threats?
Not true, says Agent A. Nothing credible. They're watching in the Haymarket on the television above the bar. The mayor is holding old Cronkite's microphone for him and might as well be interviewing himself. He says,
Certain people plan to assassinate many of the leaders, including myself, and with all of these talks of assassination and it happening in our city, I didn't want what happened in Dallas or what happened in California to happen in Chicago.
The Secret Service agents feel bristly at him bringing up the Kennedys like that. They take small, measured sips from their mocktails.
He's lying, says Agent A. Nobody's trying to assassinate him.
Yeah, but what's old Cronkite gonna do? Call him a liar on live TV?
Old Cronkite doesn't seem to have his heart in this one.
Checked out, passion-wise.
Quick break from the mayor's interview to a shot of Michigan Avenue to show what appears to be a real full-size military tank rolling down the street. On television, it looks like something out of World War II footage, like the liberation of Paris. The tank is rolling right in front of the Hilton, and they begin to feel its rumble in their bellies, and the assembled politicos in the Haymarket bar gather close to the plate glass windows to watch it rattle hugely by.
all save for the two Secret Service agents at the bar who were not surprised by the fact of the tank. It had been mentioned in the many eyes-only memos leading up to the event. And anyway, the Secret Service always maintained in public an air of unflappability and total discipline and composure. And so they watched the tank roll by on TV, unimpressed.
17. Faye has been praying all night for a rescue, but now that a rescuer has come, she hears herself telling him no.
What do you mean, no?
Sebastian says. He's crouching on the floor with his hands, holding her shoulders like at any minute he's going to shake some sense into her.
I don't want to go. What are you talking about?
Never mind, she says. Her brain feels fuzzy and swollen. She tries to remember what the house spirit had told her, but already it's fading. She can remember the sensation of talking to the ghost, but she can no longer remember what he sounds like. She looks at Sebastian, at his worried face. She remembers they were supposed to have a date last night.
I'm sorry I stood you up, she says, and Sebastian laughs. Another time, he says.
The clenching in her chest is releasing, her shoulders loosening, the bile in her stomach seeping away. It's as if her whole body is a spring after it's sprung. She's relaxing. This is what it feels like to relax.
What was I doing when you came in? She says.
I don't know. Nothing.
Was I talking to someone? Who was I talking to?
Faye, he says, putting his palm gently on her cheek. You were sleeping.
18.
Ernie Banks probably feels something else, too, whenever he hits a home run. Along with the sense of professional mastery, there's probably this other, uglier feeling. What would you call it? Payback? Retaliation? Because isn't one reason men are moved to greatness partly the need to respond in a grand way to the people who cut them most deeply? For Ernie Banks, it was the older and bigger boys who said he was too skinny. Or the white boys who wouldn't let him play. The girls who left him for smarter guys, bigger guys, guys with more money. Or the parents who told him to do something better with his life. The teachers who said he wouldn't amount to nothing. The beat cops who were leery of him. And because Ernie couldn't defend himself then, he defends himself now. Each home run is his retort. Each sprinting, impossible center field catch part of his ongoing vindication. When he swings his bat and feels that delicious thwack, he must feel a powerful sense of professional satisfaction, yes, but he must also think, I proved you fuckers wrong again. So that's an essential part of it, too. That's what's going on in Officer Brown's head right now. This is, in some ways, a reprisal. This is righteous. And he thinks of those nights with Alice, those encounters in the backseat of his police cruiser, and how she wanted him to be violent with her, to shove her around and choke her and grab her roughly and leave marks, and how he felt bashful about it, demure, shy. He didn't want to do it. Felt himself incapable of it, actually. Felt like it required a different kind of man altogether. Someone unthinking and brutal. And yet here he is now, clunking hippies on the head. It turns out he had deep reserves of brutality that were, up till now, unprospected. In a way, this makes him happy. He's a fuller and more complicated man than he thought he was. He imagines himself in dialogue with Alice right now. Didn't think I could do it, did ya? He says as he clobbers another hippie. You said you wanted me to be rough. Well, here you go. And he imagines that for Ernie Banks, the best home run is the one when the girls who broke his heart are in the stands to see it. Brown imagines Alice is here, watching him right now, somewhere in the fray, observing his new vitality and strength and brute masculine dominance. She's impressed. Or she will be as soon as she sees him and sees that he's changed, that he's exactly what she needs him to be now. Of course she'd take him back. He clunks a hippie on the jaw, hears that pregnant crunching sound, and there's screaming all around him and hippies running terrified, and one of the other cops grabs Brown by the shoulder and says, "Hey, buddy, settle down a little." And Officer Brown sees that his own hands are trembling. They're quaking, actually, and he waves them in the air like they're wet. He feels ashamed of this, and hopes that if Alice is indeed watching him right now, she did not see that. He thinks, I am Ernie Banks rounding the bases, the very picture of calm, serene delight.
19.
It is remarkable how quickly extraordinary things turn ordinary.
By now, the patrons of the Haymarket Bar do not even flinch when some thrown projectile strikes the plate glass windows. Stones, chunks of concrete, even billiard balls, all have made their way through the air over the heads of the assembled police line and whacked against the windows of the bar. People inside have stopped noting them, or if they do note them, they do so condescendingly. The cops could use an arm like that. The cops are generally good at holding the line, but occasionally a wedge of protesters breaks through, and a couple of kids get beaten up right in front of the Haymarket windows and dragged to a paddy wagon. This has now happened so many times that the folks in the bar have completely stopped watching it. They ignore it in that strained way they walk by homeless men on the street. On the television, the mayor is back with old Cronkite, and the latter appears as penitent as ever.
"I can tell you this," the journalist says. "You have a lot of supporters around the country."
And the mayor nods like a Roman emperor ordering an execution.
"It's your basic jingoistic sucking up," says Agent A. "Your basic desinformatia." Outside, a police officer strikes a bearded man wearing the Viet Cong flag as a cape, strikes him with his rifle butt right in the middle of the cape, sending the guy sprawling forward like he's diving into home plate. Face first into the Haymarket's thick leaded windows with a dull crunch that is eaten up in the bar by Jimmy Dorsey's sweet, sweet saxophone. Old Cronkite is saying,
"I have to compliment you, Mr. Mayor, on the genuine friendliness of the Chicago Police Department."
Two cops descend on the bearded man at the window and clunk him on the head.
"That is the look of someone who's given up," says Agent A, pointing at old Cronkite.
"Put him out of his misery, please," says Agent B, nodding.
"You want to see what a fighter looks like when he knows he's lost? There it is."
The bearded man outside, meanwhile, is dragged away, leaving a smear of blood and grease on the window. 20.
"Say a seagull," old Cronkite thinks. He recently took in a game at Wrigley and saw how, in the ninth inning, the seagull masses were drawn from the lake to the stadium. The birds were there to clean up the pop